We turn now to Joe Clement talking with philosopher Jason Reed about trends, hopes, and fears about neoliberalism in the time of the coronavirus.
Good morning. This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Today, I'm joined on the phone by Jason Reed. Jason Reed is a professor of philosophy at the University of Southern Maine. He's a pretty prolific blogger on his website, Unemployed Negativity. We'll include a link to that. His research and writing covers many topics, but he's a Marxist. He is a scholar of Spinoza and materialism. He writes a lot about film and television and popular culture. He writes a lot about social and political philosophy around questions of subjectivity and of the politics of work. He introduced me years ago through his blog to Kathy Week's book, The Problem with Work, which I reviewed on The Old Mole a few years back. Thanks for coming on The Old Mole today, Jason Reed.
Sure, thank you.
I wanted to bring Jason on today to specifically talk about neoliberalism and the corona crisis, and I think that makes a good starting point. What do we mean when we refer to neoliberalism influencing society and this current crisis?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's an important question. I think part of the appeal of the way that neoliberalism gets used is it gets used to talk about something more than an economic system, but begins to encompass like an entire political and cultural system. Anything which, you know, is predicated on the individual and individuals in competition. I guess one of the things that I keep thinking about is how these current measures of social distancing are strange. I mean, there's a strange kind of paradox in the sense that in the name of solidarity, we kind of give up the physical presence in interacting with others and retreat into our own private spaces, and how, in some ways, I feel like there's a real risk that preference of the private and the home over public engagement is only going to further entrench tendencies towards isolation and competition. And one way to think about this is you look at the way in which this current pandemic and social distancing is affecting people in very different ways depending on what kind of private resources you have. I mean, I walk around my dog during this time. You know, I walk by your playground, which has been closed down in the name of public health, and walk around some houses where people have elaborate private playgrounds in their backyard and their children are able to play outside, and walk by, you know, apartment complexes where kids don't have the same opportunity. So there is a sense in which there's a kind of culture of neoliberalism, a kind of sense of I've got mine for you that I feel like is further entrenched by this. I mean, I've done some mutual aid work and so on, and it is very strange. I think the strangest thing is people who are trying to fight that and trying to engage collectively is that so much of what we do collectively and so much what builds things like solidarity or being able to be in the same place with people and interact with them and doing the same thing over Zoom or phone or internet, it doesn't create the same sense of trust and engagement that you can create when you get a bunch of people in the same place. Social distancing is a strange kind of solidarity, and one I wonder, like, when we come at the end of this, what's going to be entirely transformed, and are people going to be more and more inclined to stay out of public transportation, to stay out of public places, and, you know, more and more inclined to stay in their own homes, use automobiles, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which seemed to me to be a social disaster. I mean, not saying it's the same as people dying, but it would be a destruction of something that's already very weakened in our culture and society.
Yeah, and you're already in the midst of one of these big institutional shifts with higher education and even the K-12s or the high schools attempting to switch to some kind of replacement, although they will be wishy-washy about how much of a replacement it's really intended to be, but it is filling a gap educationally and time in terms of how people structure their children's days with this online supplement. And online education already exists. There's a controversy in Portland, Oregon, where Concordia University decided to close this last year, and it had switched to an online university to try and facilitate this closure. And so what are the risks of, you know, how we are affecting our ability to even kind of communicate and educate ourselves out of this mess, depending on how deep it gets?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, yeah, my university, like many, we switched to a kind of forced online conversion. And my university already offers many classes online. And there's always been a strange thing about online. You know, the lingo you get from a lot of administrators is that students want online education, but I don't think that's entirely accurate. It's more often the case that online education is the only thing that fits with people who are pushed by multiple jobs, parenting responsibilities, and so on, where, you know, once you undermine an ability for someone to really engage with education, then online becomes the only thing that is sort of left to them. And of course, this is pushing even more people towards online. Now, a whole set of different issues with that. I mean, is it the same education they're getting? I mean, I know in some instances, especially around like schools where people are getting, you know, education in arts or performance, students are pretty much claiming they want a refund. They don't want this kind of version that can be delivered online. And then there are also concerns about how much power we're giving to some of these private companies that are delivering the online education, how much they entail their own techniques of surveillance and so on. I mean, my hope really in the midst of all of this is, and I feel the same way about this in terms of what I said earlier about the public, my hope is that maybe at the end of this, people will come to value what they're now forcefully denied, that people will begin to think, okay, now I understand what happens in a classroom is not reducible to the transmission of information or knowledge. It's its own space with its own kind of relations, and that what happens in a classroom can't really be captured in a video transmission, that has a lot more to do with how people relate to each other and how people have discussions and so forth, and to see things like classrooms as transformative spaces. But that's the optimist in me who imagines that maybe, you know, we'll come out of this thing, as we do begin to come out, kind of tired of mediated forms of communication, tired of screens. I know I'm getting tired of screens and tired of those sort of interactions, and with a real thirst for being physically present to each other and being able to interact that way. The optimist in me wants to believe that we'll come out of this maybe wanting to ditch our screens.
That leads me to want to ask about the pessimistic responses that are proliferating, especially around the extension of emergency powers, which have very serious consequences for how the government as we know it can all of a sudden open up to very autocratic rule.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing about that is that, you know, right now, and this, of course, varies from state to state and from country to country, you know, there's some version of a kind of lockdown, quarantine measures that are keeping people at home, closing some businesses and other sorts of things. To me, it seems to me the real big anxiety, especially in this country we're hearing now, is this idea that the president and other people in power want to reverse that, want to get people going back to work. And my real question is, you know, Can they do that by decree? What is it going to be like when suddenly, especially if this happens too soon, before people feel like there's been any measure in terms of testing or other thing to keep people safe, if tomorrow or someday, not too far from tomorrow, if suddenly the federal government or state government would decide, hey, you know, you're open for business, you have to go back to work, how will people actually respond? I mean, one of the things that occurs to me is that unlike other countries, especially in Europe, where governments are actually paying people's employers to continue to pay them, by and large, in the U.S., what we have is a lot of people don't have a job anymore. So they can't even be told to go back to work because they don't have an employer. And people talk about, I think there are real concerns that maybe some of the strategies that will come out in the mid period, and by that I'm referring to everything that happens between now and when a vaccine is developed, and the strategies of, say, for example, testing and surveillance. You know, we're somehow all have to register our test status and be monitored. These might be real increases of powers of surveillance, but at the same time, I feel like the thing the state very much wants to do right now, which is reopen, as they put it, get people back to work, is a thing which it might find out that is in some sense powerless to do. Although, my real concern is what this is going to do with so many people out of work and so many people with very little resources, savings to rely on, that people may find themselves going back to their jobs or similar jobs with less pay, and if they had a union and collective bargaining agreements, with those dismantled as well, that the real things that fate may be trying to do is use this entire pandemic to further exacerbate the power difference between workers and capital, where people at the end of this are so desperate for work that they're willing to accept working conditions that they wouldn't have accepted before. That, to me, is the scariest prospect, almost more than the idea of the state having more power of surveillance and so on.
There are a lot of people who are pointing to the European countries that you mentioned and others, saying that this is a perfect opportunity to roll out a universal basic income. You've written quite a bit about that. I mentioned Kathy Weeks in my introduction. And what do you think of the possibilities of this are, the desirability of it, and how that would or wouldn't interface with the longer-term project of overthrowing capitalism?
I mean, I feel like it's pretty clear, I mean, given the paltry payment that the U.S. government has agreed upon, that it's pretty clear that the biggest fear, and this has been articulated by several politicians in Texas, especially in Florida, where they've pretty much said, we're afraid that payments to be so great that people don't come back to work, right? That's always been the fear, that universal basic income will make it so people don't want to come back to work. So I think that in this country, at least, if there is any kind of universal basic income, it's going to be very paltry and very much organized around the idea of generating enough demand to keep businesses functioning, but not doing anything to jeopardize wage labor at some of the most poorly paid positions, especially. But at the same time, I mean, this is why I feel like, you know, we're very much living through a moment where it's hard to say what this is going to entail, because we're in the midst of this moment. We can't see it. And at the same time, I mean, people, the two things that really sustain our economy, both economically in terms of where dollars come from and go, but also ideologically, are our work and consumption, in the sense that both people have to work and then people find a lot of their, or encouraged to find a lot of their entertainment, enjoyment, and consumption. And both of those have been radically interrupted. People aren't working, and people are, of course, still buying stuff in markets, but they're not consuming. I mean, some people are buying a lot of mail order or whatever, but people are not consuming in that same kind of sense of enjoyment. These two things have been interrupted, and people are suddenly finding themselves making a new life in this moment that's not organized around work and consumption. And to me, that's always been the more interesting thing about universal basic income. And that's, and in some sense, that's already kind of happening. And to me, the big question is, when people have had a taste for a life not organized around work and consumption, how is that going to change how they think about work and consumption when these things start to come back? I mean, are people who have found themselves being able to spend time with family, time on things that they enjoy, are those people going to suddenly look at the demands of the working week and say, you know what, I've decided I don't want this anymore, or it's not as important to me? And there's one possibility. Of course, the other possibility is people will desperately clamber to get work back, to get consumption back. I mean, I think we're going to see a combination of both, but I think the real question is, you know, how people make sense of what's happening right now and how it transforms their way of understanding what supposedly counts as normal in this country. It's hard to say because we're in this moment. You can't really see what's right in front of your face. But to me, it does seem like in the interruption, there's always a possibility. And we're living through a massive interruption right now.
That, I think, is a good note to end on.
I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been talking with Jason Reed of the blog Unemployed Negativity. You can follow his blog, unemployednegativity.com. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Southern Maine and the author of many books and articles.
Thank you, right. Jason Reed, for the coming on to the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Sure, thank you. Take care. Bye.
Then the coal company came with the world's largest shovel, and they tortured the timber and stripped all the land. Well, they dug for their coal till the land was forsaken. Then they rode it all down as the progress of man. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train is hauled it away.